Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The buzz phrase from Beijing for China's historic surge to 21st century prominence was harmonious rise. But you don't hear that phrase so much from Beijing anymore. New leader Xi Jinping talks about the Chinese dream. And the big power Chinese dream, it turns out, has a hard edge to it. At sea, in the air, beyond. This hour on Point, a great power flexes its muscles. China gets assertive. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking as you hear the stories of China's new assertiveness at sea, in the sky, with foreign journalists, hey, up on the moon? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us first today, Beijing Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, Barbara Demick. We caught her in New York today. Barbara Demick, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Late-breaking news as we go to air that a whole lot of American journalists in China who thought they might be potentially gone in a couple of weeks appear to have press credentials coming. Why was there such a big question mark there this year, Barbara?
Well, the Chinese government, which I will point out ironically is in the midst of a big anti-corruption campaign, decided to penalize those news organizations that had been doing the hardest reporting on corruption. That was the New York Times and Bloomberg had both done some excellent stories about the wealth of the leadership and leadership relatives. So they were not given visas this year. We based in Beijing, have to renew our visas at the end of every year, and it's a kind of complicated process. I just heard tonight that some people have been told they have the go-ahead to get their press cards and presumably get their visas, but it's not quite a done deal yet. And I will say it's been extremely complicated for all of us. I do have a visa, but they've been holding journalists' passports for periods of up to 3 weeks, which is not at all great because we're traveling press, and we've been effectively all grounded for weeks and weeks waiting for visas.
It's kind of hard to picture a world in which the second largest economy would play this kind of potential hardball with foreign journalists. I mean, we just assume that there's a certain system here where we will have coverage of things that go on in the world, even when they're difficult. Is China saying it's not going to play by those rules, Barbara?
I think they're saying that there are certain topics that are off limits, and there's a type of reporting on corruption when it touches the wealth of the leadership's families that is just off limits. And it's quite interesting because the stories in question were really very well done, very fair. They weren't sneering. They were in no way China bashing. And they're the sort of stories that China needs in print in order to achieve the goals that Xi Jinping, the new president, says he wants, which is a more transparent, modern country. So the whole thing is quite upsetting, I think, to all of us who thought maybe naively that fair, open reporting could go, hand in hand with China's rise.
Now, this, of course, was New York Times reporting on the wealth of the outgoing Wen Xiaobao's family. They went through public records and more and found it at $2 billion plus, hard to accumulate on a regular official's compensation in China. Of Xi Jinping, the new president, Bloomberg dug in and found $300 million plus in his family. Maybe there's a line in the sand right there. Was it seriously thought that these two very large media organizations might end up this year excluded from being on site in China?
Yes, it certainly was, because we're now 10 days before the end of the year, and most of the visas expire anywhere between the 15th and the 30th of December. So some of the visas have already expired. And, as I say, I think most people will end up with their visas, but it's been hugely disruptive to the point of harassment. I don't want to go into the personals, but people have not been able to leave China. There have been dying family members, Christmas holidays, so actually some real life and death stuff going on. I mean, and we've mostly all been grounded waiting for the visas to be renewed.
And of course, there have been consequences for some of these media companies. Bloomberg, which also sells its business reporting terminals, saw its business just plummet in the last year after it reported on the wealth of the Chinese leadership.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, the ironic thing is, this has all been in the press, is that Bloomberg apparently killed another story exposing the ties between the leadership and one of the wealthiest men in the country. And even after killing this story, apparently to appease the Chinese government, they still had problems with their visas. Now, the Bloomberg is disputing this and saying that the story is still in the works, but they've terminated the reporter who wrote that story, Mike Forsyth. So you can see there's a very difficult position for all the press covering China.
When you're based in Beijing, we're trying to get a feel for just how awkward this has become. A Bloomberg top editor was quoted as telling his reporters that, look, we have to be careful here, like reporters had to be careful reporting on Nazi Germany before World War II. You've got to make some compromises to stay in the country and keep reporting. Was that overly dramatic? Does it feel that dire?
I think he was trying to make a point with a bit of theatricality, mm-hmm. to get it to sink. And no, I don't think it's that dire. I mean, I think there's a lot we can do as journalists in China. And I mean, it's great to report there, especially when you get out of Beijing and get to the countryside. But as I said, there are certain things that are off limits, and this leadership wealth has been one of them. I mean, another strange thing is that these stories did not allege any illegality. They showed, I think, the Washington principle that was coined, a term that was coined by Michael Kinsley, that the most egregious things are the ones that are not against the law. It showed what's really common in many political systems, that the family members of the leaders get very, very rich, through connections, or guanxi, as we call it in China. The stories did not accuse anybody of doing anything illegal.
New York Times columnist Tom Friedman came out a week or two ago and said, look, China shouldn't adopt this posture toward information flow. If it's going to be a great big power in the world, it needs to have a different kind of posture here. It should just let all the reporters stay, let the reporting roll. China's Global Times came out and said, back off Tom Friedman. They say he should have known that information security is among China's core security concerns. China's willing to communicate with the world, but it won't yield its own agenda-setting rights to the Western media. Does China really feel as though the Western media is setting its agenda for it? And if it does, and it resists it so strongly, where does this go, Barbara?
Well, the real tragedy here has to do not with the Western media, but with the Chinese media. There are terrific Chinese reporters who are working very, very hard on these kinds of stories. And I mean, the great thing would be if the Chinese press could be reporting them. But Beijing seems to be going backwards in terms of press freedom. They just announced that Chinese reporters are going to have to take an ideological exam. There's a 700-page book that they'll need to study, and it has directives in it, such as it is not permitted to publish reports that feature any comments that go against the party line. This sort of stuff, this is just such a throwback to an earlier era. And, for those of us who believe in press, it feels like China cannot become what they say they want to be, which is, a modern, more transparent, more grown-up economy without letting the press do their work.
Barbara, we're going to look at other facets of Chinese assertiveness lately, but I wonder if, to your eye as Beijing bureau chief of the LA Times, if they look up a piece, China pushing out its air identification zone over the East China Sea, this confrontation last week in the South China Sea with a U.S. naval vessel. Now, granted, that was a lot closer to China than they were to U.S. shores, but are these things related, the press treatment and these other steps, Barbara?
It's hard to say. I mean, since Xi Jinping took over the government last year as General Secretary of the party and this year as president, they've become much more forceful towards the press. There's been, you know, some back and forth in terms of their attitude towards the neighbors. I mean, you'll hear the Chinese leadership saying we want to have better relations with the neighbors and we're going to build a prosperous new 21st century Silk Road for everybody to get rich together and so on and so forth. And then you have these kind of aggressive actions that set them back. And so it's again, you know, this sort of one step forward, two steps back.
You know, I just hear you speaking very carefully. Now, we should all be careful when we report on what's going on in the world, but do you feel like you have to be hyper-cautious when you express, when you talk about China as someone who covers China?
No, not at all. I don't think I'm self-censoring at all, but I am cautious because I try to avoid this knee-jerk China bashing that always gets us. You know, it gets us great kudos in the U.S., and I know when I write a story that's very critical of China, I look at the comments below that readers post online, and it's all about these commie blah, 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 and, you know, I get a lot of applause. But I'm being careful, not because I'm worried about my visa or my status. I do want to be fair, and I do see both sides of it. I see two Chinas, and I see people within the Chinese Communist Party who, you know, want the country to mature in a way that, you know, I'd agree with.
That's good caution. We appreciate it. Barbara Demick with the LA Times, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about a more assertive China lately, at sea, in the air, playing hardball with American journalists, hey, celebrating, making advances in space. We're looking at the sharper elbows and some aspects of this Chinese rise and where this goes. Is this just the world getting used to another big player on the planet, or is it something else? And some of these things, just China growing up and doing all kinds of cool new things. Here's the sound of the launch of the Jade Rabbit. China's first moon landing mission took off December 1st.
正地摇到正好正常
Chang'e-3 headed into space said the Jade Rabbit would rove the moon within a few days, and the Chinese flag there with the U.S. hasn't been for a long time. Sour grapes around that when people look at China's assertiveness? Maybe. Got to be cautious of that. At the same time, it is very interesting to follow this and see exactly what's going on with the trend in China's interaction with its own people and with the world. To help us do that in this hour, from London, Jonathan Fenby joins us. He's a British writer, journalist, analyst, managing director of the China team and co-founder of Trusted Sources. It's a research and consulting company, author of a lot of books on China. The forthcoming book in January, Will China Dominate the 21st Century? He was formerly editor of the Observer newspaper and the South China Morning Post, my own alma mater many years ago. Jonathan Fenby in London, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And from Washington, D.C., Dean Cheng joins us, senior research fellow at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, author of China's Increasingly Aggressive Stance Toward Its Territorial Claims. Dean Cheng, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Fenby, first to you. What do we see unfolding here in these new territorial kind of claims and pushiness, and maybe beyond, with journalists and the rest? What's going on with China?
Well, I think this is part of a wider story. You were discussing this with Barbara Demick just now. And this is all, you can encompass this in a sense in the new leadership in China. Xi Jinping, who took over as Communist Party boss, and that's the most important job. It's much more important than being state president in China, but he's also state president. He's also head of the military commission. He is the strongest Chinese leader we've seen since Deng Xiaoping. He's a confident man who sets out this stall of what's called the China Dream. That may be a lot of rhetoric, and we're not quite sure what it amounts to, but it certainly means an attempt to rejuvenate the nation. Now, a lot of people thought when Xi took over with the new crew just a year ago that we had new guys in charge, and that must mean new policies. Well, actually, what it's meant is politically, in a sense, a step back, because Xi has spent much of this year calling for Communist Party unity, stamping on dissent, bringing the media into line, quoting Mao Zedong, and insisting on, you know, the need for loyalty. He's been using an anti-corruption campaign to get at people who might cause him problems, in theory. So you've got this political, in a sense, straitjacket being reimposed. At the same time, very interestingly, just last month, he put his name to economic reform. At least it's a long-term, a seven-year plan, but he put his name to that. So you've got this combination of political orthodoxy, if you like, being imposed very strongly in China, mm-hmm. and a readiness to use economic reform to strengthen the system. And the whole, I guess, with the foreign journalists and with the regional policies, I think that all forms part of this stronger leadership which we're seeing in China now.
Dean Cheng, maybe this is just part and parcel of being a big world power. I mean, a lot of our listeners are picking up on that perspective on this. Donnie writes to us. He says, look, it takes two to tango. We claim they were hacking Google. Look at what the NSA has been doing around the world, Donnie writes. Here another listener says, we look at their territorial claims with raised eyebrows and more, flying B-52s right through there. But look back to the United States and its Monroe Doctrine in the 19th century. Is this just the way it is for big powers, Dean? What's happening here?
Well, I think that part of this is China feeling its growing pains as it transitions in an unprecedented growth pace. China went from one of the top 20 economies in the world in the 1990s to the number two economy by the mid-2000s. That was an incredibly fast pace. But I would disagree with Jonathan Fenby, because I think that while Xi Jinping absolutely is putting his own stamp on things, I would actually suggest that he might actually be a surprisingly weak leadership, in part because the rest of the top communist leadership is, in fact, older people who are going to have to step down in less than 5 years, in 2017, simply due to retirement ages. And so you've got a top leadership that is doing all the things that Jonathan described, which is to say stamping on corruption, trying to establish control. But at the same time, it's really got a very limited lifespan itself. Xi and his the premier Li Keqiang will be able to stay in power, but the other top leaders are going to have to step down. So right now, they seem to be in a consolidation phase for what may be a fairly weak government. The other aspect here that I'd also note is that when it comes to foreign policy, Xi is continuing the policies of his predecessor, Hu Jintao. We saw the Chinese interfering with U.S. Naval ships in 2009, the so-called impeccable incident. We saw them interfering with Indian ships in 2011. So there's a certain degree of continuity here as well.
But when our listener says, hey, what about the Monroe Doctrine? We said, you know, to Europe, stay out of an entire hemisphere. The Chinese claims, while they are large, look modest compared to that.
Well, the part of the problem here, of course, is that the Monroe Doctrine was declared in the 1800s. And the reality is that the Monroe Doctrine actually wasn't enforced by the United States, but by the Royal Navy. The U.S. actually didn't really have the power to enforce it. The other piece here, more importantly, is that today, if China were to declare a Monroe Doctrine, that would mean that it was essentially telling countries like Japan, countries like the Philippines, countries like Singapore, how to run their foreign policy, which is something that perhaps the Singaporeans and Japanese might disagree with.
A couple of moves there in the air and on the sea. Earlier this month, right before Vice President Joe Biden's recent visit, the Chinese Foreign Minister spokesman Hong Lei here was rejecting criticism of an airspace expansion, the air identification, air defense identification zone that China declared out into the East China Sea. Said China had not broken any international laws. Said Japan was the one at fault. Here interpreted by CCTV.
The United States should respond to relevant issues in an objective and fair manner. Secondly, as I have pointed out earlier, the country that has unilaterally changed the status quo and created tension in the region is not China, but Japan.
Let's pick up the air identification zone first, then we'll look at the incident with the ships last week. But Jonathan Fenby, here's China saying, look, we're not making this sovereign space, but we want you to check in if you fly over this zone off our eastern shores. And get guidance from us before you fly over. Now, this overlaps with Korean airspace, with Japan airspace in those terms. But China says this is not so unusual. And the next thing you know, the U.S. flies two B-52s right through it. Who's right here, Jonathan?
Well, there are quite a lot of these air defense zones around the world. Mm-hmm. They normally aren't much commented upon. The Chinese one does go further. It goes into space claimed by other countries, of course. But I think really the B-52 incident and the way the Japanese airlines have decided not to take notice of this shows up China as a pretty much of a paper tiger if they wanted to use it actually to control in an excessive manner.
Paper tiger, really, because the B-52s deliberately did not check in. They just flew over and Japanese.
Of course, they just flew over and they weren't going to shoot down the B-52s, were they? I mean, they're not going to start a world war over something like that. I think China's basic problem in the area is, as you've been saying, it wants to assert itself much more. It has no allies in the region except for North Korea, which is the only country with which it has a formal alliance. And it has several countries in the region, including the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan, which have treaties of alliance with the United States, which is there 100 miles off the Chinese shores. And when President Obama met Xi at the Sunnyland Summit in California in June, the Chinese said, well, the Pacific is big enough for both of us. That is true, in a sense. The problem is that the other power in the Pacific, the United States, is based in Okinawa, with a big carrier group there, allied with Taiwan and with the Philippines. And you can understand that the Chinese feel a bit encircled by this.
And then we come to last week. The Chinese are out with their new aircraft carrier out on a training mission, a bunch of other ships around it. This is not so far from China. There's an American destroyer. And one of the Chinese ships, we are told, essentially cuts off the American destroyer, stops dead in its path, not that far in front of it. We're told the U.S. ship had to take emergency measures to avoid a collision. Today, Chinese state television, CCTV, spoke with senior captain Zhang Junxie, vice president of China's Naval Research Institute, about the quote-unquote near collision between U.S. and Chinese ships. The Chinese official saying China was following international law and protocol, and the U.S. was not.
The USS Carpens was fully aware of the demarcated training area. But this U.S. naval warship ignored the Chinese navigation notification and entered the demarcated training area. So it is very clear which side did not comply with international laws and international practice.
Ding Cheng, the last thing we need are Chinese and American warships colliding at sea. And yet this was, by all accounts, a close call. The Chinese say, back off. We brought our aircraft carrier around. We're near our shores. Don't be out there snooping on us. The Americans say, wow, you almost caused a collision here. Who's in the right here, Dean?
Well, the Chinese have been claiming that much of the South China Sea, under what's called the Nine Dash Line, also sometimes called the Oxdung, is all essentially under Chinese control.
This is way beyond what would normally be under their ocean space, sea space.
Oh, far beyond. Mm-hmm. This goes beyond international law. It goes beyond the law of the Sea Treaty. And the U.S., under the freedom of navigation, along with other maritime countries like India, the United Kingdom, have consistently tried to make the clear to China, look, you can have an exclusive economic zone where other countries can't come drilling for oil and fishing. But what you can't do is keep countries from transiting through, including their warships. This is freedom of navigation. And what the Chinese have been trying to do is to change what's sometimes from customary maritime law by doing things like this and by saying, look, we have our laws. If you want to transit through, all you have to do, as the Chinese senior captain was saying, was you have to obey our laws, which in this case would have meant staying out of those same waters.
And yet the waters are close to their shore, closer to their shores than ours. On the other hand, as you say, we're in a global era now where there's maritime traffic all over the place. It's hard to figure out exactly how to weigh these things. Jason in New Haven, Connecticut. Jason, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call today. Yeah. My question really corresponds to, in New Haven, we're pretty close to New York City, and is anybody off the coast of New York, either in the air going through an ADIS we have up or in the water, doing the opposite to us?
Yeah. Dean Cheng, how about it? What if there were Chinese warships as close to the American shore as American warships are there? Jason, with a sympathetic eye on China's circumstance, Dean.
Well, China at this point doesn't regularly sail into the Atlantic. But back during the Cold War days, Soviet submarines regularly transited through what would now be considered our exclusive economic zone. And Soviet bombers flew through what is essentially an ADIS all the way down to Cuba and back. These days, Russian bombers are again flying into the ADIZ off of Alaska. So, in fact, the reality is that this does happen. And the Chinese have indicated that they fully expect that their warships will sail into comparable waters around places like Hawaii and Guam. At this point in time, I think that it's only a matter of time there.
Jonathan Fenby, there are consequences with this. Japan, just in the last few days here, has outlined a new defense path that they're calling something like aggressive pacifism. I forget what it is, but they are preparing to arm up in a way that they haven't since World War II. In no small part, it appears in response to China's move. It has consequences when China begins to flex in this way. Is this again inevitable, Jonathan?
I think it is. I mean, this is really one of the great global tussles going on at the moment between China, which has been used for some time to Japan playing a kind of subservient political role, and is now finding that under Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, Japan is also becoming much more assertive of its own position, if you like, politically and strategically in the area. And of course, the history between these two countries goes back a long way to the War of 1894-5, when Japan defeated Imperial China, and then to the long Japanese occupation of Manchuria, and then invasion of the rest of China from 1931 to 1945, with atrocities, the rape of Nanjing, etc. And these two countries have never made up between them. And certainly in China, you've had since the 1990s what's called patriotic education in all schools, where children are basically taught that Japan is the number one enemy. And as I say, Japan has been quite quiescent towards China, seeing it as an economic opportunity. But now, under Abe, it is taking a much higher profile. So we have this dispute over the uninhabited islands, which China has laid a claim to. And I think this will go on and on. And it's going to be one of the global flashpoints in 2014, with the danger of an accidental clash coming between the two, which would then, of course, also drag in the Americans.
Dean, that's where this gets unsettling. The United States has all kind of obligations to Japan in the circumstance in which it feels it's under attack. The potential for some kind of knock-on effect here, this would be catastrophic if we get into that kind of terrain. Are we getting closer to it?
Well, certainly, since 2010, tensions around the Senkakus have been steadily rising. There, it was a case of a Chinese fishing boat which accidentally rammed a Japanese Coast Guard vessel, and things started to get out of control to the point where China actually cut off rare earths exports for a while, affecting the global economy. With the declaration of the ADIZ, you now have a situation where the number one economy, the United States, the number two economy, China, the number three economy, Japan, and one of the other top 20 economies, South Korea, are all basically flying eyeball to eyeball. When we think of the 2001 EP3 incident, where a Chinese fighter and an American patrol aircraft collided, and how that put U.S.-China relations into a tailspin, sorry, no pun intended there, for quite a few months, the situation here could be very, very dire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a more assertive China lately, at sea, in the air, even with American journalist Dean Cheng is with us from the Heritage Foundation. Jonathan Fenby is here, former editor of The Observer, South China Morning Post, now at Trusted Sources, author of Will China Dominate the 21st Century, out in January. China pushing out that air identification zone, encountering U.S. vessels at sea to its south. On Monday, China's Central Television reporting on rising tensions with Japan.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Heng Lei has strongly refuted Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's comments. Abe said China had taken unilateral action to change the situation in the East China Sea. Heng Lei says China is very angry with the Japanese Prime Minister for his malicious slander against China.
And here's the U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel saying he's worried about some miscalculation that could lead to confrontation.
China's actions raise regional tensions and increases the risk of miscalculation, confrontation, and accidents. And restraint is critically important.
Jonathan Fenby in London, Dean Cheng in Washington. Let's hear from our listeners. Kaiser's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Kaiser, you're on the air. What do you see going on here?
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We definitely can talk about, you know, the rise of China and India. But I think parallel to this topic, we should also talk about the diminishing, you know, status of U.S. as a superpower. I mean, we are going south. The rest of the world is going north. Now, that is one point. Secondly, you know, China, you know, there was a, you know, how could China forget what Japanese did to them when, you know, Japan was in a position of strength? They will never forget that. And I know because I come from that region. Chinese will never forget what Japanese did to them. And now, if China is in that status, you know, they will flex their muscles. They would let the Japanese know. And Japanese right now are in no position to confront China, militarily or economically. We have to recognize that the world has changed. One of your guests just talked about, you know, China not in a position, you know, to come to Atlantic or whatever. But, you know, during the Libyan crisis, even the Iranian ships went to Mediterranean Sea and they rescued their people. So the thing is, the rest of the world is rising. We are going south. The rest of the world is going north.
I appreciate your call, Kaiser. Dean Cheng, what do you make of that analysis? The U.S. is weakening. China is strengthening. There's going to be a grinding of gears.
Well, that's actually been one of the great worries in the U.S. national security decision-making bodies is the question of how does a rising power, China, deal with the established top power? This is – and whether or not the tensions we're seeing are in fact necessarily going to get worse. It's been something that was in the previous administration, the Obama administration, have all been trying to get their arms around this problem. What has – created a new condition, though, is that up until very recently, the Chinese themselves tended to downplay their own rise. They tended to talk about maintaining Deng Xiaoping's policy of maintaining a low profile. Mm-hmm. Beginning with Hu Jintao, you started to see China being more assertive. And now under Xi Jinping, we see a much more public willingness to challenge. The previous caller just talked about China-Japan tensions. Well, those tensions aren't new. And yet we're seeing them becoming much more of a daily irritant throughout the region, this ADIZ being just the most recent example. And so it may be that there's these longstanding tensions, and it's true, but it's taking a very new, much more assertive, arguably much more aggressive form. And in the midst of U.S. sequestration, it's raising some real questions about how well the U.S. will be able to stand up to a China, particularly as its own defense budget drops.
Jonathan Fenby, what do you foresee? I mean, there are different angles to this. There's the hard power face. You see it when one naval ship cuts off another. That's potential steel against steel. Then there are politics. There are nationalist sentiments in lots of countries, including China. When China extended that air identification zone, I'm reading here reports of, you know, Chinese citizens online celebrating that, saying this is exactly what we want. You know, we want a tougher China, cheering on Deng Xiaoping. Here's Here's somebody writing in the People's Daily saying, you know, if this raises the risk of confrontation, this is a danger we must have the courage to shoulder, this view in China. So what's rhetorical and what becomes real, material expansion, potentially conflict, Jonathan?
Well, the Chinese blogosphere is notorious for its, let's say, overstatements. I don't think you want to take that too literally. It makes good copy.
But Xi Jinping understands the nationalist sentiment in his own country.
Absolutely.
As a politician, he has to deal with it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And as I said at the beginning, his whole agenda of the China dream, national rejuvenation, a stronger army, a bigger global position where China aims to be equal number one with the United States, all that involves nationalism. There's absolutely no doubt. And that's why I said at the beginning that I think this is inherent. This is at the core of the Xi Jinping approach. And I think, although Dean was querying me on this, I mean, we know who the next set of leaders are going to be in China, taking over from 2017, and they are people who are largely Xi Jinping's own protégés. So, you know, he's got his 9 years to go. And I think that he and those around him have made this strong nationalism a central element in the way they want to run the country. They've just set up a National Security Council, which will probably be more dealing with internal than external security, which Xi will almost certainly chair. And the army, they're trying to modernize the army, which would lose a war if it fought against the Japanese, or particularly against the Japanese and the Americans. And the question is whether this nationalism and this stronger national stature can be used to get through what will be a difficult 2 or 3 years for the economy if they're serious about bringing in reform. That will mean lower growth, higher inflation, and you've got many myriad problems to deal with, which is part of my new book. And I think nationalism will increasingly be used, as often happens in history, as an attempt by the administration in Beijing to get through an otherwise quite touchy and difficult period.
Dean Cheng, where do you see the most concrete risk of things getting rougher here? I mean, nationalism can be kind of semantic. Where might it become concrete? And when Xi Jinping takes over, creates and then chairs this National Security Council, is that to try and get a firmer hand on the military so he doesn't have some kind of accidental confrontation?
I think that the idea that the PLA is somehow operating outside the control of the civilian leadership is something you hear a lot of. And I really am always deeply troubled by that line of argument because there's actually very little evidence of this. I think the idea of creating a new National Security Council reflects bureaucratic problems within China, not so much over control of the military, but simply out of the fact that the system is so badly stovepiped that there's almost no interagency communications. We think of the Chinese as almost monolithic, but this is one of the oldest bureaucracies in the world in a system that truly values information and control of it, whether it's to the outside world through the press or internally bureaucratically. I think that Jonathan's right that this new National Security Council will be heavily focused on domestic affairs because right now there are, we think, somewhere between 100 and 150,000 mass incidents a year. These are domestic protests covering the gamut from corruption to consumer product safety. That's where part of, I think, the Chinese are pushing nationalism is, look, we're a rising power. Have faith in your leadership. Yes, there are these problems, which, by the way, we discourage reporting on. But we are going to be able to try and overcome this and be proud in being Chinese. And, oh, by the way, in the process, we're going to establish this National Security Council to deal with these internal security problems.
Jonathan, what about this information issue? China likes information control. Now it's a great big global presence. I'm reading Hannah Beecher. She writes for Time magazine. You know, China liberalized its treatment of the foreign press in the run-up to the Olympics in Beijing, but it has tightened up again since then. Hannah Beecher, writing for Time, says China is now the world's second largest economy. It has to please no more. And Ms. Beecher saying that, you know, how China treats the press. I mean, not that press freedom is perfect in any place. We've seen the editor of The Guardian have a pretty tough time before your parliament recently, Jonathan Fenby. But Hannah Beach saying that this has a bearing on how the world will conduct itself in coming years. So first, China, do you see it over the long haul being open to the kind of coverage that many other nations are subject to from international press? Or do you see international press norms changing in response to a new power with perhaps a more tight-lipped attitude on information exchange?
Well, the answer to your first question is, I'm afraid, no. As a journalist, I wish I could see an evolution. And there are some very good media organizations in China, some of which actually run articles by me, which are pretty critical of the Chinese system and the Chinese leadership. So there are areas there where there is a certain degree of freedom. But as the propaganda director, and China has a propaganda director, who's a senior Communist Party figure. As a propaganda director said to me, told me back at the end of the 90s when I was editing the South China Morning Post, so long as the Communist Party remains in power in China, we will control the organs of information. They see information as power. The potential game changer in this is social media. You've got around 300 million, the equivalent of Twitter and social media accounts in China. A lot of those are multiple, so it's probably around 200 million people, actually. Now, most of the traffic on this is, of course, the usual kind of thing. You know, I saw your boyfriend out with another girl last night. I had a nice breakfast this morning. So but the important thing is not what is transmitted, is that for the first time in Chinese history, because of modern technology, people are in the habit of communicating directly with one another without official filter and official control. And of course the regime tries to keep on top of this. Of course a lot of the media sites are submit in fact to censorship. This is also, but I think you've got an evolution, and that's part of, and again this is one of the themes of my recent books, that you've got this social evolution in China, and it's particularly the younger urban middle class who are now used to living in a way that their grandparents and their parents didn't live. They make 80 million journeys abroad every year. They see how the rest of the world works. They can get round the Great Firewall of China, as it's called, by getting an account into Hong Kong, where there is freedom of information and so on. So this information control is going to be increasingly difficult for the regime, but it's something which clearly Xi Jinping and the party apparatchiks would very, very much like to control. And I think the effect of that will be that probably controls will be stepped up rather than going the other way. I'm sorry to say that, but that's how I see realistically it working out.
Let's go to Eric in Endeavor, Wisconsin. Eric, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom, real quick, I got comments for both your guests. The first one said that China censors stories that are off-limit for the press, and it's so ironic, but I think the real irony here is that USA controls its own media through prosecution and changing laws to try to prosecute people who are formerly protected under you know, the law currently.
Were you talking Bradley Manning or Edward Snowden, that sort of thing?
Exactly. And then they just rename it something else and call it illegal. And for your second guess, the somewhat weak government, wouldn't they need to consolidate to become less weak? Wouldn't it be foolish not to do that?
What about the comparison there, Ding Cheng? China on press controls, the U.S. on Bradley Manning, Edward Snowden. What do you say?
Well, I think that when you are working for a government agency and you sign an oath that says that you will take care of classified information, that release of that classified information constitutes both a violation of the oath and a violation of the law. The other thing to keep in mind here is we actually do have laws that protect whistleblowers and the like. And in fact, some of those whistleblowers have come forward to defend people like Snowden and Manning. I think that in China, where an average journalist, foreign or domestic, can be locked up, where, as Jonathan Fenby noted, there is a minister of propaganda. I think comparing the two is sort of comparing apples and sofas. I mean, just two completely different worlds.
Yeah. I mean, reporters pushed around, beaten up, and all the rest. I mean, nobody's got perfectly clean hands here, but there is a difference, I suppose, with with functioning journalists and leakers. But you hear Eric's view right there. Jonathan, how do you answer the question you raise with the title of your book, Will China Dominate the 21st Century? Do you come to a yes or no?
I do indeed, and it's the second, if you want.
You say no, and why? Why?
Well, because, I mean, there is a great China bull story, which some people have put out. There have been books written this, you know, including one, When China Rules the World, and so on. Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't think China actually wants to rule the world. This is a rather old-fashioned way of looking at things. Secondly, I don't think any one power can dominate the world anymore. Thirdly, China doesn't have a foreign policy. Fourthly, which would enable it or help it to do so. Fourthly, the list of internal problems that China has at the recent Communist Party plenum, the most important meeting in China this year. There's a document that came out of that, which you can get hold of, if you know how, which lists the challenges and problems China faces. And it's a really major shopping list, if you like. So the leadership recognizes this, but that's what it wants to deal with in the first place. It's not with world domination. It wants to make sure of various things. It doesn't want other countries to intervene in its domestic affairs, particularly not in Tibet and Xinjiang. It doesn't want anybody to stop reunification with Taiwan when it decides the moment is right for that. It wants to make sure of the security of supply routes, these maritime supply routes largely, for the raw materials which China needs and the export of goods, which it also needs to keep its economy going. So for all these reasons, it's got quite enough on its plate, and also, despite American decline, relatively, America is still, I think, well ahead.
Dean Cheng, very quickly, wave action here. These tensions rise, they'll recede again, or we're going to see mounting tensions as China's power may grow?
I think at the rate we're watching the Chinese become more assertive, particularly with countries like Japan, which are U.S. allies, I'm afraid that we're going to see a lot more tension in the coming several years.
Dean Cheng at the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Dean, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And Jonathan Fenby, his book is Will China Dominate the 21st Century? You heard his answer, but interesting analysis. Jonathan, in London, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you very much. I didn't want to give away the answer,
okay,
but I felt I had to.
There it goes. Out of the bag. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.